could hang on. Yeah. Keep it in visual context.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wouldn't tell him that story even today.
So, so just let this run just for a second till it gets on the tape here. So,
this was followed.
Indicate name of officer of the watch.
Pennant 3, following letters to be spelled alphabetically, B-U-D-G-E.
Yeah.
And everybody on deck of this ship and Skeeter knew Budge was in trouble.
Yeah.
And what a witch beach was that? He was sure, he said, Budge, you will remain on watch until you're back in station.
Yeah.
Because immediately after, as soon as they spell out Budge, VGB sent the message, and I remember this, every word of this message. The only thing I don't remember about this message was its time of origin. He said, this officer is to be relieved forthwith and is not to be permitted to keep a watch by himself until personal orders from me. Bad. Boy, oh boy, I could hear the drums rolling and ripping off my stripes and marching out. Oh gosh, it was a blow. And our widget mate said, you will stay. So he finally left the bridge, and I thought, well, thank God, give me a chance. The first problem was to get back in station. And, you know, we were full out. So I phoned O'Brien Spencer, and bless his heart, O'Brien was,
yeah, was
all, I explained to Brian, I said, this is my problem. I said, I've got to get back in station. So he went down, and he managed to squeeze a few more revs out of his old engines, and slowly, 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 we got back in station. And, this is well past. So I'd been on watch for a hell of a long time by then, by the time we finally got her in station. And I thought, now, what the hell has happened? Because, you know, the gyro, if there was anything wrong with the gyro, and I knew the gyro intimately, I knew damn well that no matter what happened to the gyro, the gyro alarm, if it was defective, the gyro alarm would warn the bridge personnel. And damn, no bridge, no blatted alarm had rung. So I sent for my EA. It was a Scotsman. I said, you've been cleaning the trolley contacts? He said, yes, sir. I said, did you switch off the alarm circuit? He said, yes, sir. I said, what the flaming hell? I said, you do switch it off the alarm circuit when you're going to mess around with the trolley contacts.
Yeah.
And he couldn't answer because what a stupid thing to do. And so that was it. So Boomer Hope was detailed off to come up and sit in the captain's chair cleaning his nails while I carried on the job of officer watch until we got to London, until we got to England. And on the way back, I there was no signal being made, but I was allowed to continue on the way back. Well, this was my second encounter with VGB. On the way home, we had to drop into the Azores, Punta Delgada, to fuel. Very, very tricky harbour. Oh, tricky as all get up. And you had to go in bow first, turn on a buoy, secure your stern, and there's very, very little room to do either. Skeeter went in and did just that, and it was getting late at night. We followed, secured our bow to her, and then slewed around and to button our stern to her. And I was quarterdeck officer responsible for securing the blunt end. And there was a flaming AB who, 2 days before, I'd put in the rack, a few days before, I'd run in for returning on board drunk. And he bore a very definite grudge, and he was holding the forward spring, the after spring, leading forward.
Mm.
And the beggar deliberately dropped it early, when I wasn't looking too. And it dropped down, and damn, as soon I just heard it splash, and I saw it drop right down. And I said, red flag, stop it. And I was letting the red flag, and by the grace of God, it was stopped. But it had caught in the screw.
Oh, gosh, yes.
We wouldn't come. Victor Brodeur was standing on the quarterdeck, and he had those sort of eyes that when he was angry, he seemed to bulge right. And just a few yards across, he saw the whole damn thing happen. And he called out in a voice loud enough for everybody here to hear. He said, "Budge, you will be personally responsible for removing that in the morning." But for some reason or other, it had to be done in the morning. I forget why. Probably it was getting too dark or something. And oh gosh, you can imagine, this was the second episode of how bloody depressed I feel. But bless his heart, O'Brien Spencer came to the rescue again. He said, "Oh, Budge," he said, "Donna." He said, "I got the DESA down there, the Davis Submarine Escape Apparatus, which had been hanging on the bulkhead for about 5 years. It was installed there when I was building, when the ship was being built.
I had to trust myself to it.
So at 4 o'clock in the morning, I got up, and O'Brien, bless his heart, came up with the handbook for Davis.
How to put it on?
Yeah, put it on, and I tended him on a line and done it. Fortunately, it was not very long, and by the grace of God, it was only just one loop around, and so he had really no difficulty in freeing it.
So Brian Spencer lifted it off.
Yeah, and when he came up, he was dead. He did the bloody thing. The chemicals that was supposed to give him good, fresh, refreshing oxygen, they'd been on the bulkhead too much.
And died years ago.
He killed himself. Poor old boy. But bless his heart.
Oh, he was a kind man.
So there was it. So, while I'm at it, I may as well finish the episode of my encounters with VGB. Finally, after the recent the struggle for democracy was over, the end of the war, I found myself first lieutenant of Maiden. And VGB, who'd spent most of the war over in Vancouver, boss of the area, Jericho Beach, yeah, as boss of the area, came back and settled into the Admiral's House in Dockyard for his final term. And it came time for him to retire. And for the first time since the war, a mess dinner was to be held in Royal Roads. Mm. And Wallace Creery was the CO of Royal Roads, who was the commandant, and it was such a big affair. There were so many people wanted to go, and it was such a tribute to a very, very remarkable man, old VGB, that they held it in the new mess, the new cadet wing. And Bob Welland was first lieutenant of Royal Roads, and I was sitting on his right at the end of the table. He was Mr. Vice, of course. After the other end of the table was Creery. With the great man on the, and even old gosh, I can't think of his name, his predecessor, Beard, Tasher O'Beard, was there. He'd retired sometime, maybe he came, and they even had nurse and sister, the first time nurse and sister had ever been to a mess dinner. And Tisdall was commander of the barracks, and Doe Donald was around, and it went on and on and on, and everybody seemed to speak, and everybody sort of treated the subject very lightly. You know, nobody spoke the truth. I'm talking about old VGB, and meanwhile, I was telling Welland VGB stories about VGB, and he was fascinated by them. And as the dinner droned on and on and on, finally, old Bob Welland got to his feet. I could have cut his flaming throat. He said, "Mr. President, I have here sitting beside me an officer who served with the Admiral both as a rating and as an officer. I think we should hear from him." And old Wallace Creery, who must have known me or something, and yet we'd served together very little, I heard him say, "Good God, Budge, we'll be up here for hours." So I got on my feet. I said, "Mr. President, Admiral, it is true that I had the honor of serving with the Admiral both as a rating and as an officer, and I retailed one or two stories, of my experiences, A, when I requested for leave, B, when he fired indicating name of after the watch, and how he chewed my balls off of the wire. And I, you know, what a disciplinarian. You know, I said he'd run his own mother-in-law in. And finally, I wasn't long on my feet, but I said, in the lower deck, I said, we regard him as a just old bastard. And there was a shout went up, and I said, therefore, Mr. President, I request permission to call for 3 cheers for the old bastard. And, you know, they got to their feet, they cheered the hell out. And of course, this happily, it broke up the dinner, you know. And as they broke off, old Pat Distel and Joe Donald were patting me on the back. They said, good old buddy, it's time somebody spoke the truth about the old bastard.
Yeah.
And, the realization began to hit me. I said, good God, there you go, buddy. Talking out of the back of your neck again, always talking yourself into trouble. And they all trooped over, and they left the cadet wing and went over to the
castle. The
wardroom, over the castle, you know, the big room in the castle. And I was one of the last to get in there, and I stayed well back.
Yeah.
And there he was, the great man was in the middle.
Yeah.
And he was surrounded by this great gang. And suddenly the great man was speaking. He said, "Where that budge?" And, and these guys that have been patting me on the back and said, "Quickly open and push me forward. Here he is, sir." And the old boy said to me, he said, "Budge, why you no tell them why they call me Scotty?" And I said, "Oh, I said, I thought you better tell them that, sir." And I was scared to tell them why. And the reason they tell him Scotty was, goes back to the time, you know, he was sacrificed, and the word is actually used, by his father, who was Minister of Transport. Mm. Detailed young Brodeur when he's 16 years old, hardly ever heard a word of English in his life, "You will go to the Navy." And he was thrust over to the RM, and boy, you can imagine, no English, as a midshipman, you can imagine the life he was given in a gunroom. But anyway, hey, I give him full marks. He gave as good as... And eventually he was, attuned to be a gunnery officer. And one of the D-class cruisers, he was Starshell Control Officer. Now, you probably had experience of Starshell Control pre-war. Nothing ever works right. Nothing ever did work right with Starshell in those days. I've heard it so often. And he was... voice by controlling the guns at this exercise. And there was Black of the Cow's Guts with the star shell, with the star shell exercise. And sure enough, enemy inside, bearing so-and-so, all guns on. And then the captain ordered, "Open fire with star shell." And so VGB, eagerly bending over his voice by, said, "Open fire." Deadly silence, which all, so often, what's the delay, open fire, and he kept, of course nothing happened, so the captain got mad, and he started chewing the ears off his Starshell controller, "Get let me go, you want open fire with a flaming Starshell, will you?" And of course, under the pressure, old Victor Brodeur forgot all his English, forgot all his French, and was trying to say, quick man, instead he came up with, vite more, half French, half English.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the British sailor, hearing this, and knowing his accent and this, immediately nicknamed him Scotty.
Yeah.
And this is why old VGB was called Scotty. Well, and then shortly afterwards, he went on leave, and almost a year later, here I was a commander now, or an acting commander.
Wait a minute, now where are you?
Still in Maiden.
Yeah.
I'm no longer first lieutenant. They shifted new entry training from Cornwallis to Maiden.
We've lost a lot of years here.
Well, I'm still on the Brodeur Storm.
Ah!
I'm still on the Brodeur Storm.
You're a commander, yes.
Yes, you see, I was, as first lieutenant, Jumbo Weber was sent to continue Cornwallis training in Maiden. He was sent to, he was eventually sent to Uganda, I think it was. Yes,
she was on this coast.
Uganda or Ontario, I'm not quite sure which, as XO. And I was to continue the job of new entry training as a 2.5. Mm-hmm. Here I am a 2.5. Which I was as first attempt, which I clued up at the end of the war as a 2.5. We'll get back to that later on.
Okay, I'm all right now.
But this is a continuation of the VGB story. And so here I was in charge of new entry training as a commander. And we had got, Dutchy Ed was never attended divisions, and I religiously made new entries, and everybody got a division and prayers. Yeah. If the Proudly wasn't there, I said them. And we had guards and bands, and we saluted the king and the queen every morning. And then I heard the great man was coming back to pay his final, to make his final medical. And I thought, gosh damn it, I hate to see him slinking out of the Navy like that. I think a man that has contributed so much to the Navy, and is such a historical part, although you ask any man, any officer down there, who the hell's Victor Prodeur, I don't know whether they tell you. But he was a great influence. And so I thought, damn it, I'll see if I can't provide a garden band. So I phoned up Pat Tisdall. I said, look, I think we should have a garden band for VGB when he comes in for his final visit to the Navy that he served so long. So Pat says, oh, you'd better ask the captain. So I asked Dutchy Edwards, an old Dutchy who never came in very often during the forenoon. If he did, it was about 11 o'clock. He'd say, and he said, well, do what you like. You only want your training officer. So I trained a guard, and the morning that he was due to come, marched up to the gate, and along came VGB in a taxi in plain clothes. I was disappointed in this. I thought, well, damn it, he can carry an inspection. So I went up to him. I wasn't part of the guard, the officer of the guard. I went up to him and saluted. I said, sir, I said, I paraded a garden band for your final inspection. He was furious. He said, I am not into Navy now. I'm not going to inspect any guard now. He said, I am leaving the Navy. I said, you're part of the naval history. I said, these young men have only heard of you by name and reputation. I said, at least they should continue their service in the Navy, at least knowing that you've at least seen you. He scowled at me. Okay, bud. And he walked up and down the guard. Not too graciously, but he did do it. And off he went in to have his medical. The next day, his chief steward, in those days the admiral was allowed a steward and a cook. His chief steward came over to my office in the new entry training office with two boxes. He said, sir, the admiral wants you to have these. You know, and I knew by the shape of boxes what they contained. And in it, in one box, was his full dress uniform as a captain that he wore when the Navy was presented by King George VI with colours on Beacon Hill Park. And he sent me over the full dress uniform, and in the other box was his cocked hat with his beautiful epaulets, which I still have at home waiting to take to the Maritime Museum.
This one here?
Yeah.
The BC Maritime Museum? Yeah.
He retired to Vancouver, and I think he died at the age of 82 or something. Yeah. And I still think of, I'm scared of the old boy still, but yeah. I still regard him with. So, let's get back.
Well, let's just say this. His son Nigel is a rear admiral.
Yes. Oh, I told this story, but before I told it, I said Nigel. As a matter of fact, Eggie Wirtle was supposed to speak at the opening of the Victor Brodeur Ecole, the French school in Maiden. Mm. And when they opened it, Eggie Wirtle, who knew him very well, even better than I, was asked to speak, phoned and asked me, would I do it? So I said, yes, I would. And I was going to relate some period, some episode. I wasn't going to make it too long to show him what a disciplined and a really blamey officer he was. And beforehand, I met both Nigel and I can't think of the elder son's name. One was by his first wife, whom I knew very well because as a young boy, he used to paint the laundryman's horse's hooves when it came to collect the laundry. And he would come down the Saguenay and help us paint ship, and it was always in trouble. And shot old VGB as he had an ERA as his chauffeur, as a coxswain.
Yeah.
And he shot a BB while he was cleaning the car. Young Philip, shot a BB gun on his backside. He was a devil, Philip. But I met both Philip and
Nigel,
and I said to them, "Do you mind if I tell these stories about your dad?" They said, "No." So I know that Nigel will not object to this story being noised abroad.
No.
So there's my... However, I continued on in Saguenay. There's one little episode with Kenny Dyer that I would like to recite.
May I make a quick call?
Yes. Our son was Kenny Dyer, who is the most wonderful guy.
Oh, yeah. There.
And we got on so magnificently, Kenny and I. And he would play a joke or two on me, and I would play a joke or two on him. But he got his own back on. Mind you, it was an occasion long after the Sperry event of when I got dismissed from the bridge. But Frankie Houghton was the captain, and we were required during the noon hour to leave number 4 jetty and go up to the Imperial Oil to...
excuse me, I'm going to get her out of your way. Puppet, get over there.
To fuel. And we just got off St. George's Island when it was obvious that the tank had not cleared and we'd have to piddle around until she was gone. And it was obvious that it was going to take an hour or so. So Frankie said, "Well, I'm going down to get my lunch. You just keep her here, guns." And he said, "We'll go along about 1 o'clock or something like that." So there I was, just keeping ahead of the stream off George's Island, and it was approaching noon. You know, we had got no charts. So the cover of the chart table was still down. It was we were just going up there to fuel and go back again. There was no need for a lot of fuss. And 12:30 was approaching, and time for Kenny to come up. And he was a very, very prompt reliever. Always relieved on time. So this time up he came, right on the dot, 25 after, and listened. I was taken over for him. The other way around. Mm-hmm. And normally he said, "What's for lunch?" And I would say something that he liked particularly, and it never was sort of business. And he would always believe me and go down sort of business. And he'd say to me, and yet he would always say, "Budgie, damn it, why'd you tell me that?" And yet he would always believe me and confidently go down expecting to get roast pork with nice crackling for lunch.
Yeah.
So, but this time, he was always so thorough in turning over and watching complete details. But this time he dropped it in my lap and, said, "We're waiting for the tanker to clear, the captain's having lunch, both engines are stopped, just keep her abreast of George's Island, and the captain will be up let the captain know when the tanker clears." And was off. And it was so unusual, because Kenny turned over a thorough watch, and then just to be friendly, he would stop and have a chat and make sure that you were comfortable with him. But no, away he went. And it was something that I thought, there's no need for panic. Here we are, stopped, nothing much doing. And so we just a slow head now and again. And then about 10 minutes after he left, "Well, you're not going to catch me this time." With one jump, I was at the voice pipe. We were going slow ahead, but with one jump, I crawled down the voice pipe and immediately steer by magnetic. Blasty gyro alarm. Steer by magnetic. South, 20 degrees east, or whatever it was. So I lived on and on and on. The bell went on and on and on. then it sort of dwindled away. I thought, damn it, that's not the gyro alarm. And I lift, and I was in a complete, and I was trying to get hold of the captain,
yeah.
You know, trying to get hold of the EA
yeah.
to get the gyro fixed. I'd said, messengers running all over the blatter chip. And I lifted up the corner of there's something wrong with the sound. And I listened, and I lifted up the corner of the canvas of the chart table, and there was a flaming alarm clock that had rat-faced Kenny Dye headset. Mind you, he was only fair enough because I pulled I pulled a couple of fast ones. As canteen manager, I managed the canteen, and you're always getting samples of this. And some salesman gave me two of the filthiest things, bitches hair tonic and bitches hair dressing. Shampoo, Fitch's shampoo and Fitch's hairdressing. It was the foulest, foulest stuff. And especially the shampoo. And Bully Pressy was going to get married. And this was quite the fact, you know, frock coats and...
Bully Pressy.
Yes, or how to stop it.
Yeah.
And he had that cured.
Yeah, do you know what it was?
Yes.
His eyes, not his neck.
Yes, yes. I found that out later. Yeah. And he went all that time, how to stop it. And, oh, gosh, people could tell you stories about Pressy. What a man he was. And anyway, he was getting married up at St. Mark's Church. And okay, we were all getting ready for it. And, suddenly I remembered that. Harry, suddenly, Kenny from his cabin saying, Budgie, you got any hair creep? And immediately I thought of this.
Fitch's.
Not the hairdressing, the shampoo.
Yeah,
I said, sure, I got some. So instead of taking the hairdressing, I took along the shampoo. I said, Kenny put his hand up for it. I said, oh, God, lots. I'll put it up for you. So I put this, I said, rub it in good. And then he dashed out of his cabin. Well, in a few seconds, he had a hair just like a woolly head.
Yeah, a white woolly head.
White woolly head. Oh, gosh. And, you know, he didn't really have time to rinse it all off. And consequently, at the wedding... But he got even with me. We had a lot of fun with Kenny.
Yeah.
Well, time went on in Saguenay, and along came the struggle for democracy, the wartime. And I went over with a bunch to pick up a Cinnabon.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny came with us as the gunnery officer, and Roland Mingy as commanding officer, and Jimmy Hibbert as the first lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And from there we came back and eventually grew up in the West Indies, watching for a German merchantman at Aruba. Mm-hmm. And it was the SS Hanover, a brand new beautiful passenger cargo job, diesel job, practically new, and we waited and waited and waited outside to catch her. And with us was the Australian cruiser, I think it was the Dunedin, I'm not quite sure about that.
Yeah.
And we waited and waited, and finally she sailed, and we caught her at Mona Island Passage.
Yeah.
And we were drifting early in the morning, and the Germans, they flooded, they opened up all the seacocks, covered their diesel generators with oil-soaked oakum and set it alight, and abandoned ship. Well, we were alongside in no time. Stokers went down from both ships and opened...
What both ships?
Dunedin and...
Dunedin and you, yeah.
And us. Dunedin went alongside and landed put a bunch of stokers on board, and they shut the Kingston valves, but they couldn't. They put out some of the fire. They saved the generators, but there was a fire in the cargo. There's explosives in there that they set it alight. But we were drifting into Haiti,
mm-hmm.
And. There was a real genuine fear that we'd be within the 3 mile limit. And Dunedin shouted out to Miggy, get her in tow, clear. Because the Haitians in a frightful looking little old tugboat had seen the Germans pull in ashore, but they evacuated and pulled like hell. We captured some of them, and the Haitians were coming out, and so Dunedin shouted for Mania to take her in tow, and I happened to be on the forecastle, and we forgot all the business that tow fired and tow off. He said, never mind the fancy work, get anything to it. So I grabbed the berthing horses, mm-hmm. and we just wrapped them around both bows, jumped around, and we towed her out, bow to bow. We went stern first to get her clear. Meanwhile, these Haitians were shouting.
I see. You were bow to bow.
It was bow to bow.
And then you went stern first and towed
we
her.
Went stern and, we went astern and towed her clear. Yeah. With the Haitians shouting, you are in the 3 mile limit. Yeah. But we weren't actually. Yeah. But of course they tried to make a claim.
They wanted the loot. Yeah.
Oh, you bet they did. Well, we towed her to we towed her towards Kingston, and we tried everything. We tried steam to put out the fires, and I got my Willie Porteous was our engineer officer, and we got out my metal high power hoses to try and put steam, but they seemed to melt the solder, and wouldn't do. And consequently, she developed a tremendous list. And that night, she was in tow of Dunedin. And they had a crew working on, but they finally got the generator going. And that night, Dunedin said, carry out a submarine search, because there were words of submarines around. Carry out a submarine search to the south. Join me at daylight tomorrow. Well, I happened to be on watch, doing the middle watch. And I had no idea, the guy who turned the watch over to me had no idea where he was or where the tow was. So I got to the chat and I did a little bit of plotting. I'm patting myself on the back, but I got so few pats on the back that I like to record them. So I had a rough idea where she was, and I inched in very, very cautiously to find out where she was. And by the grace of God, I caught an exchange of the shaded Morse lamp, very, very shaded. I just caught a flicker of it, and I estimated our distance to be 1.5 miles. So I put my X where we were. I knew what her speed was, a few knots. Mm-hmm. And I plotted out a sweep to the south. And I had to plot it out, so I'd be back at 5 o'clock in the morning, which was approximately near daybreak. So I plotted all this out. And Jimmy Hibbert relieved me for the first attendant, if you will.
4 o'clock.
Relieved me for the 4 o'clock. And he said, what's all this? I said, well, if you followed these courses and that course at these times and that time, and I said, you follow that course, I said, at 5 o'clock, you should sight. You should be within a mile of the tow. And he was pretty doubtful about it. But, you know, I did the best I could, and I went down below. And so next morning, Jimmy said to me, and I really, very rarely got any marks from Jimmy Hibbert. And so old Jimmy sent for me, he said, you know, he said that the captain came up around about four. He said there was some doubt. He said, you were going to be for the high jump, he said, at 5 o'clock. They caught the same thing I did, the flash of the rope. And he said the captain was very pleased. So, you know, this is one of the first that I'd ever earned after all the trouble we did. Anyway, we came after sometime in the we got Hanover into Kingston, and they saved her. And years later, in the Ottawa next, because we went back to Halifax, and Jetty Jones, Rollerwinger was transferred to the Ottawa, and we went out to plough the Atlantic for a couple of years using Greenock at the base, and we had a new first lieutenant, which I think was Bill Hatton.
Where are we into now? Ottawa?
Ottawa on the Atlantic, convoys. And
nothing happened in the Assiniboine in the way of enemy action?
No.
All right, now.
It's there that Sub-Lieutenant Pullen and Sub-Lieutenant Hennessy joined the ship.
Ah, yeah.
And they were there for Christmas Day. and they went rounds, and I think this was the first time, and the troops really laid for them. They really filled them with rum.
Hennessy and Pullen?
Oh, Pullen, young Pullen,
yeah.
Tom Pullen.
Tom, yeah.
Tom and Ralph, the two sub-lieutenants, they really loaded them. A funny thing, I met a petty officer the other day, he said, you remember the reindeer we sent over to Dunedin? And what they got was coat hangers, you know, one ringer up coat hangers, and they take them to their foreheads, and eight of them reined themselves up, and they galloped over to, in all the heat, in tropical rig, in the Kingston, alongside Dunedin, and toured the ship, and they thought we were crazy. They were crazy, which they were. Mm. But anyway, we in Ottawa, and finally we came back to, after a year or so, on the Atlantic, we came back, and Ronald Mingy was to become Captain D, Halifax.
Hang on now, you're in Ottawa, who's captain?
I'm in Ottawa, and Mingy is the captain.
All right.
Mingy is the captain.
What year are we in, then? You're in about 40.
Ottawa. 40, yes. Yes, 40. So
the war's not really started on this side of the Atlantic.
While we were in the ship, Gus Bolton was, as a lieutenant, VR lieutenant commander, was promoted lieutenant commander and was made for first lieutenant. The first VR, first lieutenant of an RCA destroyer. Mm-hmm. And Gus was a good one.
Yeah.
He knew his business and was a damn good first lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And whilst we were at sea, there came a signal promoting all three of us. Mingy was promoted to captain. Bolton was promoted to lieutenant commander. And Budge, bless his heart, was promoted to commissioned gunner. And, of course, they all wanted to wear their stripes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I knew my way around with the needle. So the captain sent his uniform down, and I showed his fourth stripe on. But Gus Bolton was a different colour, because those wavy navy stripes are damn difficult with gold braid. I said, I'll tell you what, Gus. I said, it's a working uniform. I said, I've got some yellow felt. So out of yellow felt, I cut the pattern of the VR stripes, and I showed him on 2.5 in yellow felt, which was good enough for seagoing.
Sure.
And when we got into harbour, he got his proper gold braid on. So we came back to Nova Scotia, to Halifax, and Ronald Mingy was to be made Captain D. Halifax. And he said to me, Budge, he said, I'm taking you as my torpedo officer. Which was astonishing, you know, as a flotilla T, as a commissioned gunner. But however, off I went, and my initial job was to check depth charges and torpedoes and just a general job around. But then the corvette started to come down, and Mingy was sent from Halifax to Newfoundland, and Gus Miles. who took over as Captain D. And it was then that it was Gus Miles who sent me on training duties, which I carried on for some time. Then eventually it became such a big job that Jimmy Hibbert came back from sea and was promoted commander, and he was made training commander. It was he who initiated a lot of the innovations that did so much towards the training of the corvettes. I was on there for about a year, and it was damn hard work. Yeah, July 41 to May 42, yeah. And then finally one day I came back from a week of living in a hammock, training ships, because they had no spare bunks for me, and I used to take a hammock along. And Mook Madrick, who was flotilla gunnery officer, met me. Sambro was the name of the base, you know. Did you know that?
No.
The name was Sam. They called it Sambro. HMCS Sambro, which was sort of Captain D's abode. And there at the entrance...
Where's this in? Shebucta Bay?
No, it's in the old... it's in the new building. You know, they rebuilt the barracks,
yeah,
in which I joined the Navy,
yeah,
with the intention of improving accommodation.
Yeah.
But the war came along and it was converted to the operational headquarters.
Yes.
It became operational headquarters.
Ah.
And Sambro was that portion of it responsible for sea training.
Yeah.
And outside, late at night, bless his heart, was old Mook, who served with me in Ottawa.
Excuse me, once more, was that HMCS Sambro?
HMCS Sambro, yes.
There it is.
And he's standing on the steps with the boatswain's pipe, and piped me on board. I said, "What's this they're made of, Mook?" He said, "Your lieutenant's rank came through." So I continued training with, I was pretty proud of that.
Sure.
As a lieutenant. And then one Sunday, that Jimmy Hibbert acquired a cottage down at, thank God he did, down at St. Margaret's Bay, because, you know, we used to work 18 hours a day, but Sunday was sacred. And we would go ashore, and I would sleep most of Sunday. And I had a young VR lieutenant. I didn't know much about his history. His name was Hope.
H-O-P-E.
Hope. I don't know whether he was related to Boomer. I think he was, in some respect. But he was the sort of assistant to me. But he was a Nova Scotian man, knew his way around. So we were there for this Sunday morning, and he said, "Would you like broiled lobster for lunch, Budgie?" I said, "Boy, yes, sir." So he went off and acquired a couple of lobster and put them in the oven. And we'd eaten an enormous broiled lobster for lunch. You know what it was like living aboard the ships, you know, bangers and mash for lunch and this sort of thing. And we were dizzy with sleep and snoozing at a very hot fire. It was cold as hell. There was ice on the bay. And knock on the door, and I went, there was Commander Hibbert, Jimmy Hibbert. And he said, "Oh, Budge," he said, "I've got my wife with me. May I bring her in?" I said, "Well, certainly, sir." So in came Enos, and Jimmy was sat down and warmed him. He said, "A fine thing to find my training officers here fast asleep with lobster shells. He said, you should be out there training ships," which is exactly like Jimmy. He knew damn well we allowed ourselves Sundays off. So he said, "Well, I've got news for you, Budge." Oh, he said, I want you to... Now, I'm jumping a point. I must go back a bit, because in between he came down and said to me, "Budge," he said, "I want you to take over Sorrel. She's up at Lunenburg." He said, "She is to become the training ship for corvettes." He said, "You're to make her the smartest and most efficient convoy corvette there is. She's up at Lunenburg, go and take her over." So I went up to Lunenburg, and I took over the Sorrel. And I brought it down to Nova Scotia, and I took 3 weeks in. And I worked a morning, noon, and night.
That's your first command?
This is my first command. Boy, was I proud of them.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh, I worked them out. And they were as keen as mustard. There was an ML during a violent storm in Margaret Bay who had not got an anchor watch. And she was in one of the small coves there and drifted onto the shore, where I was hugging the coast with both anchors down and steaming ahead to keep afloat. And I got her message. So in the morning the wind died and we went in, and this bay was full of ice. And I had to go in stern first with men dodging around. It's an uncharted bay in as much as there were no soundings. So what I did, I said, men were dodging around on floats with sounding with hand lead line, and I'd go stern a little more, and they'd hop in a bit, and finally
they were outboard on the float,
on the ice, dodging around. One or two of them got wet, but we didn't lose it, and it was bitterly cold. It was bitterly cold, but we got a line up and dragged her, and I managed to get her ashore, and you know,
nice to get her afloat.
When I got her, delivered her in Halifax, we didn't know it at the time, but the ship company was suffering from hypothermia. And the doctors put us all under 24 hours rest. Anyway, shortly after that, it was after that that I had an unfortunate accident. They mounted pom-pom guns, Oerlikons rather, on either side of the bridge of this corvette. And secretly, unbeknownst to the ship's company, I got the chief ERA to rig up a barrel with a pole stuck in out of it. And when nobody's looking, I slipped it over the stern and then steamed 6 miles. Now, I warned the troops that they are under war conditions. I had everybody ready, you know, upteen lookouts, clothes up, and I'd stressed, look out. Eyeballs are much better than Asbic for detecting something. And we turned, and nobody knew about it, but I swore to the chief to secrecy, and sure enough, up ahead came this thing. Action stations. You know, they really thought it was a submarine, you know.
It was a periscope.
The only shot. And they rattled the flame and things, and they went and gunnery fire after an open fire, and bang went the 4-inch forward. And when the Oricans came in, but there was a stay coming down just in front of the bridge. And as he swung around, one Oricon shell hit that, exploded, the fuse exploded, and went amongst the 4-inch gun's crew. A few got splinters in their bottom, and that's but one guy had a splinter here, and he fell, and boy, oh boy, he was in bad condition. So we had a sickbay tiffy on board. I immediately turned and headed for home, as fast as she would go. And the sickbay tiffy said, she shouldn't be moved. So I said, well, rig a shelter around him. And so they rigged a shelter, and he was bleeding like nobody's business. So the sickbay tiffy cut it off, and we got back to Halifax, but he died on the way back to hospital. But she really was she was a good ship's company, and I wasn't in her very long, but it's recorded in the book. And it was then, after this, that there was a knock on the door, and Jimmy said, I got news for you. He said, and you know, tribals were the big thing.
Big
in
ships.
Our Navy, they were the
biggest were big
thing.
Ships.
And anybody worth his salt in the Navy who could get the lowliest of jobs in a tribal thought himself blessed beyond measure. And he said to me, he said, you've been selected as first lieutenant of Huron, you're to leave for England on such and such a day. Boy, oh boy. Well, Myrtle was living in Halifax at that time. She'd come down from Toronto with a baby Wendy, and off I went to England. And boy, it was the proudest thing when I stepped on board this rusty-looking old construction job Newcastle,
yeah.
Vickers at Newcastle. Jeff Phillips was the
engineer.
After.
Yeah.
He and I stayed with her until she was finally commissioned. And, she was a splendid ship. Now, the story of the Huron, I'll give you in the copy of the thing that I will give you,
mm-hmm.
along with this. Herbert Rayner was my captain,
yeah.
And we had an excellent team.
So you're captain the whole time there?
The whole time I was in her.
Yeah, that's right.
The whole, because after about 18 months or 2 years, we came back, and we were both relieved.
What year are we in there?
Huron, 43, July. Actually, I went there in March and stood by in March of 40.
No, not 40.
Oh, no, let me see.
Huron.
March 43, yes, March. And she commissioned in July, yes, that's right.
And you left her when?
I left her in... December of... No. Oh, this is a bit silly.
I've made a mistake.
There's a mistake here somewhere.
She commissioned in July 43 and you left her in 44? After a year? Don't look at that. You were there about a year? As number 18 one?
18 months. I was there 18 months
right.
at least.
All right. 18 months is number one.
Yeah.
So that takes you into 44.
44.
Which takes you into
for a short while, they were building Micmac and Nootka. And they had an RN, an overseer from the Royal Naval Dockyards,
yeah.
to help them out with it. And he came over to Huron to find out anything as a result of battle experience,
yeah.
that would help him, that should go into the ships. And I spent a lot of time with him. And
Are these the night actions? The tunnel operations, yep. prior to D-Day, wiping
yep.
up the...
Yep.
You sank 22 ships in six months or something?
Yeah, it'll be all in this thing, yeah.
It is in there, is it?
Yeah, I'll send it out to you, Hal.
good, because that is an important bit of our history.
It's a good detailed section that will not normally, I don't think, be in naval records, because in the Canadian naval records, where it was written by Basil Jones, because I don't think our records would have the enemy point of view, which he got.
Who was your gunnery officer in?
Watson, Alan Watson.
Alan Watson.
A damn good one, too.
Now, just, you pardon my professional interest, you went in at night, usually with a cruiser. A cruiser illuminated.
Once or twice with a cruiser.
Once or twice with a cruiser. One of you illuminated, and the rest of you went into rapid broadsides at the Elbings.
That's right.
Or merchant ships, or M-class minesweepers.
Yeah, or anything that was moving.
Or flag ships, or anything to move.
Exactly.
Did you ever get, were they shooting back? You had Elbings, you were saying.
Oh, yes, they shooting back. Yes, we got some wounded, one man killed, and a bit of the director shot up a bit. The director Lair shot out of the director, but we replaced him, and the funnel shot up a bit. And incidentally, by the way, here we come back again. I made mention of it. And on one occasion, we'd been shot up a bit then, and when we were told to rejoin, Eskimo brushed us and did a lot of damage to our boiler casing, our pom-pom platform, and it was dark, you see, and we were all rushing around at 24 knots, and Captain D said, rejoin, return to harbour, because, you know, daylight aircraft, you know, this is what we had to watch out for. And in joining, in the low visibility, Eskimo gave us a brush, and we had quite a lot of damage as a result of that, as well as being shot up a bit. So when we got alongside, you know, there was the business of re-ammunitioning, getting the grub on board. Because any time we were out for action, because we used to leave at 6 o'clock in the evening and come back at 8 o'clock. At action stations the whole damn time. Well, up until 5 o'clock in the morning when we were clear of the aircraft zone. Mm-hmm. We'd send the watch below, watch off below, and the other one would take her into harbour. And I like to pipe down in the afternoon, so I was on the jetty getting the supplies on board. The ammunition was on the outboard side, which Watson was looking after, and I was trying to hustle them so we could pipe down at noon. And, you know, there's a sort of interest whenever you've been in action and any dead being carried. The dockyard made his flotter to come and have a look and to see the blood or to see the damage, see how much work they got to be done. And I was standing there hustling up the troops, and suddenly I realized there was somebody standing there, and I looked behind me, and there was a rear admiral. And I looked up and looked at their face, and who should it be? None other than Arthur Ninian Dowley. And he said to me, he realized instantly I was the first lieutenant. He said, what happened, number one? You know, he could see all this mess around. So I told him about the action. And it was so obvious, a seagoing man wishing the hell he could get out to sea. You know, it was so obvious. And he listened with interest in every little detail. And every question he asked, he was so absorbed in it. So we chatted there. Then he sort of apologized. He said, I'm sorry, number one. He said, I see you're busy. But
you identified yourself?
Not yet.
Not yet.
He said, I see you're busy, number one. He said, I know I'm taking up your time. I said, excuse me a minute, sir. I said, but I'm an old ship of yours. Mm-hmm. So he looked at me. And I said, HMS Dispatch on the China Squadron. And jaw dropped. He said, well, and he couldn't understand. He said, well, he said, how come? He said, I was a boy seaman aboard an HMS Dispatch during the China Squadron. And he said, well, how come a boy seaman? He said, his first attempt at the Canadian destroyer. So I said, well, my family moved to Ontario after I came home from China. I said, I requested a transfer. And that was it. He said, well, thank you very much. And off he went. So time went on. We fought our battles there and we're busy as all get out, but that blessed relief boiler clean finally came around. And so we had 3 to 4 days which we could send the troops ashore. And I thought, well, thank God I can go short with that a bit, because, you know, number one job, as you well know, is
well, you're at action stations all night, you get in at 8 o'clock, ammunition ship all day.
And you've got to work all the rest of the day. And I was, in addition to Hal, I was plotting officer. And I always had to analyze and compare the plot, to send it in the captain so as he could. So I had practically no blatted sleep at all.
For weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So anyway, here it was. So Alan Watson, who was a nice fellow, we planned to go to Torquay, which was the place to go.
Yeah.
You know, all the Americans and people, the hotels were open, and dance bands and this sort of thing.
Palm trees
and floozies and all this sort of thing. So Alan, and you know, Alan was a decent-minded guy, and we had a good relationship, so we were going to have a good meal and spend some time there. And it was at noon, and I was just getting ready to go, and there was a telephone call. Quartermaster said, you wanted on the phone, sir, so I went, and it was the Admiral Secretary. He said, this is Secretary to the Admiral Superintendent of the Dockyard, Admiral Dowding. He would like you to come to dinner on Sunday. Well, listen, you know, I wanted to go ashore, and yet I wanted to go to dinner. So I said, well, if you excuse me a minute, I said, I'll ask my captain. I didn't know what to do. So I went in, I knocked on Herbert's door. I said, sir, I said, the Admiral Superintendent has asked me to dinner on Sunday. I said, I want to go to Torquay. What should I do? So he looked at me. He said, you should go to the Admiral, of course. But why should the Admiral ask you for dinner? So I had to briefly tell him what happened, you see. So I thought, well, that's fine. I was quite happy about it, really. So I went for a short run ashore locally with Alan Watson. We toured the local botanical garden or something, and which he preserved in pictures. I still have them. And so on Saturday, late Saturday, I thought, well, it was in the summer, I thought, well, I must find out exactly where the Admiral's house is so that I'll be there right on time.
Yeah.
So I went to reconnoitre.
We've both done that all our lives.
I walked around the dockyard, inquired, and found my way to the Admiral's house. And as I approached, there was a lady on her hands and knees planting tulip bulbs. And I sort of walked around an angle road to there. And believe it or not, how I recognized her. All I'd seen her was twice.
Yeah.
Twice I'd briefly seen her going over the gangway.
Yeah.
And damn it, I recognized her. Mm. So I walked back, and at 6 o'clock or whatever it was on Sunday night, I knocked at the door, and I was admitted in. And they were most gracious. He was delighted to have a chance, A, to talk with somebody at sea, and to have somebody that, because he was so proud of his, as we were, of that ship, the Dispatch, because she'd done so well there. Mm. And
nice to have one of his boys
say it.
He did
have a chat. And he said, you know, he said, he said, oh, Belcher, he said, he's captain of so and so. He said, I tried to get him. Well, this guy was the navigator on board, and he was a lieutenant commander. And once when the steam navigation company shipped the Kun Xing, which was the mail boat going to Weihai Wei, where we were anchored, was entering in a gale, she went ashore.
Mm.
And this Belcher, which is not his correct name, I can't be, but he took the seaman's cutter, and they pulled over in frightful weather and managed to get a grass line and got a lot of got the people off of this ship. And we talked about that.
Spell Kun Xing for me.
I think it was K-O-O-N-S-H-I-N-G, I think.
Two words?
Two words, definitely.
And that was near where?
In Weihai Wei.
W-E-I-H-E-I.
It's the northern summer place for the ships in China. You know, cool, that sort of thing. Not much there, just a canteen and that sort of thing.
I never find it on the charts, probably.
I doubt it. And
So dinner there, yeah?
So, and we talked this over. And I said, that was the only time you ever called me by my name, sir. So he looked at me and said, how was that? He said, well, I said, I've been on the ship 2 years. I said, I never, except for when I got promoted to ordinary seaman, which I said nothing. The schoolmaster said everything, and the captain said, rated ordinary seaman to date from so-and-so, and I told him about turn double match. I never said a word. I'd never spoken to the commander, and the commander had never spoken to me. And when the first time he spoke to me, he used my name, I damn near fell over.
Yeah.
And so I said, and this was at his dinner table, I said, the only time you spoke to me, I said, sir, I said, you used my name. And you know, and both his wife, they were fascinated with these stories.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, sir, it occurred as the navigating officer, the officers of the Kunshin, were leaving the ship. I said, one of them had left his raincoat in the wardroom, and you turned around and said, Budge, go down the wardroom and get Mr. So-and-so's raincoat. You know, I'd never been in the wardroom flat before.